authors, but in the mid-80s there was so much waste paper to be thrown away as soon as they had been read and reviewed. Today, email, PDF and the e-book and iPad are beginning to put an end to the age of the bound proof, as they have to the age of the motorcycle courier, of course. In the 80s, every phone call between editors and journalists, agents and clients, producers and writers, lawyers and lawyers, included phrases like, "I'll get it biked over to you." "Bike it over, I'll sign and bike it back. Is it small enough for a bike or shall we cab it round?" London in the mid-80s buzzed and snarled to the sound of 550cc Hondas and Kawasaki 750s swooping and skidding around you, clipping your wing mirrors, revving at the traffic lights, and terrifying the citizenry with their desperado devilry. I shall divert for a revealing story that a friend told me round about this time. Her aunt had been checked into Moorfields Eye Hospital, where she was due for a corneal graft. Cataract operation, or similarly routine but nonetheless delicate ophthalmic procedure. She was lying in bed, wondering what was up, when the consultant came in. "Ah, Miss Treadway, how do you do? You've had the operation explained. What we do is we cut out your nasty, cloudy old lens and replace it with a shiny new donor one. Simple as can be. Trouble is, we don't have any donor eyes in at the moment." Oh, I shouldn't worry, though." He went to the window and looked out over the city road. "It's raining, so it won't be very long." You know there is something amiss when a doctor can absolutely guarantee that if the roads are slippery, a fatal accident will be sure to befall a dispatch rider somewhere in the city, and that a fresh, healthy pair of young eyes will soon be speeding their way to the operating theatre packed in a cool box. A cool box bungeed to the pillion of a motorcycle, in all probability. Well, that was London in the pre-fax, pre-internet 80s. Couriers and cars did the work, and it was matter in the form of massy atoms rather than content in the form of massless electrons that had to be conveyed from place to place. But I was telling you about the stinker. It was inevitable that sooner or later in my career as a literary critic I would open a courier's package, who were now but shush, and find a book about which there could be nothing good to say. "Well, if you haven't anything nice to say, then don't say anything," is the recommendation of most mothers, and as always their advice is worth considering. The difficulty comes when, as mentioned, iron has entered the soul, and charity, compassion, and fellow feeling have fled it. I shall refrain from naming names and titles, but The Stinker was the one that propelled me into meanness. I sharpened the nib, dipped it into the most caustic solution available, and set forth to make my feelings known. Just as when a beautiful person is beautiful in all their lineaments, hair, nose, ankles, eyelashes, and nape, so when a writer is bad, they seem to strike one as bad in every particular, from style and syntax to moral outlook and spiritual worth. There will be those reading this book who have come to that same conclusion about me, although it is probable that they will have cast it down in disgust before getting this far. Unless they are reading it for review, of course, in which case I shall have cause to shudder, or rather my mother will, since I do not read reviews. I might have hoped that the nameless author of the nameless book that I so mercilessly tore into never read my review either, but I happen to know that they did. Oh, I was witty, devastating, and, to anyone who read the piece, incontestably convincing and incontrovertibly correct. I adduced quotations with which to condemn the poor author out of his or her own mouth. I questioned their sanity, sense, and intellect. I proved that their book was not only bad but wicked, not only imperfect but opportunistic, creepy, and deluded, all of which I sincerely believed it to be. It really was a most awful piece of work, this book. Had it been cack-handed and incompetent but well-intentioned and unobjectionable in disposition, I'm sure I would have let it be. Since it was The Stinker, however, no feature redeemed it, and I let myself go. I mustn't overstate things. You should understand that plenty of worse reviews were written of that book and of other books that week. Plenty of meaner and more disapproving pieces are written about books every week. Nonetheless, my article would certainly cause anyone who read it to wince and to feel for the author. Why am I lingering on this book and my review of it? In a long life of offering up works for public scrutiny, I have had my own share of negative critical notices. I no longer look, and my friends know better than to commiserate with, or occasionally to congratulate me, on a review that I will never read. But in all the years during which I could not resist checking my reviews, and on reading them felt myself punched and lowered and dispirited by the savageries or cruel perspicacities levelled at me, I never felt a tenth as chronically dreadful as I did in the weeks following the publication of my assault on the Stinker. I lay awake at night picturing his or her reaction. On the cowardly level, I imagined that one day, when I least expected it, I would be waylaid by this now wholly deranged and indigent ex-author and have a quart of actual vitriol flung at my face as revenge for the quart of virtual vitriol I had flung in theirs. In less egoistic moods, I pictured their misery and humiliation, and I felt like the worst kind of bully. What right had I to make them unhappy? What business of mine was it to hold up to the light their infelicities of phrasing or falsities of reasoning? Where the fuck, in other words, did I get off? Any number of reviewers and critics will tell you that if someone chooses to present a work for money, then the public should be warned before making an expenditure that they cannot recall. If you writers and performers don't like the heat, they say, you can get out of the kitchen. What right, they will add, turning the question around, do practitioners of theatre, literature, film, television, or any other art have to be immune from informed opinion? Are they only to be lauded and applauded, pampered, praised, and petted? I cannot deny a single word of these and many other of the cogent plaidoyer routinely offered by criticism's apologists. There are all kinds of responses and attitudes that can justify the art and practice of reviewing, but none of them, not a one, addresses the question of how you live with yourself if your wicked wit, shrewd insight, and scornful judgment will have hurt someone, will have them crying themselves to sleep, or worse still, how you can live with yourself if you realize that you have become the kind of person who does not even care that they regularly cause pain, suffering, discouragement, and loss of self-regard in those trying to earn a living in their field. It is weak, it is wussy, it is probably a betrayal of everything the Cambridge literary ethos from Leavis to Commode stands for, but I am much less interested in artistic standards, literary values, aesthetic authenticity, and critical candour than I am in the feelings of others. Or in my own feelings, I suppose I should say, for I cannot bear to feel that I have offended or that I have enemies. It is weak, it is wussy, but there you are. And for that reason I was relieved when Alan Corran took over The Listener and suggested that I move away from literary reviewing and contribute instead a weekly column on general topics that might appeal to me. From that day on, I have only agreed to review a book, film or television programme if one proviso is understood and accepted by the editor commissioning me. The review will be favourable or, if the product is so dreadful that even I cannot find a good word to say about it, there will be no article. I am less fastidious about kindness to the digital devices, smartphones, and computer peripherals I sometimes review, but then their origins are usually so much more corporate and so much less personal. However, if it ever got back to me that the designers of a camera or the authors of a new piece of software were weeping because of something cruel I had said, then I would probably pack in my geek reviews too. Most of all, I refuse to say anything bad about the work of a friend. My literary integrity can go hang, but friendship is sacred. Of course, by telling you this, it allows you, were you so minded, to look back at the blurbs and jacket quotes I have given for writers I have known and speculate that when I wrote brilliant, harrowing, lung-achingly funny, I might really have been thinking grisly, horrible, arse-seepingly incompetent. You will never know. One of Alan Corran's favourite academic stories was one of mine, too. It concerns a don, often identified as Sir Arthur Quiller Couch, that great mustachioed Edwardian doyen of letters, author of children's adventure stories, and responsible as Q for the great edition of the Oxford Book of English Verse. Apparently, he was welcoming a new fellow to the senior combination room at Jesus, the Cambridge College, where he roosted for the last 30 years of his life. "We are delighted to have you here," he said, putting an arm round the young man's shoulder. "But a word of advice. Don't try to be clever. We're all clever here. Only try to be kind. A little kind." Like most university stories, this one is variously attributed, and it probably never even happened. But, as the Italians say, se non è vero, è ben trovato. Even if it isn't true, it's well-founded. I wrote a weekly listener column for another year. The tattler-smelling duties lasted only a few months before Boxer and I parted by mutual consent. The puns were threatening my sanity. I continued, meanwhile, to tap away at the keyboard for other publications as often as I was asked to. I seemed to be in almost limitless demand, and so long as I didn't have to breach my peculiar rules on reviewing, all was well. Confirmed celibate. How did it all begin? Why did editors fasten upon me in the first place? What motivated Mark Boxer to be in touch? Why did Russell Twisk make an approach? Well, it is possible that I owed my journalistic career, such as it was, to a man called Jonathan Meads. If you watch good television, you will know who I mean. He wears charcoal suits and sunglasses and talks about architecture, food and culture high and low as brilliantly as any man alive. For many years, he was the Times' restaurant critic, and there are many who might think that, pace Giles Corran and his generation, he has never been surpassed in that field. In the mid-80s, he had some kind of position on the Tatler. Features editor is, I think, the proper description. He got hold of my telephone number somehow, perhaps from Don Boyd, who knew everybody.
"Forgive me for calling out of the blue," he said. "My name is Jonathan Meads, and I work for the Tatler magazine. I got your number perhaps from Don Boyd, who knows everybody."
"Hello. How can I help?"
"I'm putting together an article in which people write about something they don't do. Gavin Stamp, for example, is telling us why he doesn't drive, and Brian Sewell is giving us a piece about never going on holiday. I wondered if you might be able to weigh in."
"Gosh,
So, is there anything you don't do?"
I scrabbled frantically around in the recesses of my mind. "I'm afraid I can't really think of anything. Well, I don't strangle kittens or rape nuns, but I'm assuming this is about things we..."
"About things we don't do, which most of humanity does, exactly. Nothing?"
"Oh," a thought suddenly struck me. "I don't do sex. Would that count, do you think?" A pause followed that made me wonder if the line had gone dead. "Hello? Jonathan?"
"400 words by Friday afternoon. Can't offer more than £200. Deal?"
I cannot entirely understand to this day why I withheld my body from sexual congress with another for as long as I did. Kim and I had been partners in a complete and proper sense at Cambridge and for a month or so afterwards. Since then, I'd become less and less interested in sex, while Kim had pursued a more conventional and fulfilled erotic career and had by now found himself a new partner, a handsome Greek-American called Steve. Kim and I still adored each other and still shared the Chelsea flat. He had Steve and I had my work. If I have a theory to explain the celibacy that began in 1982 and was not to end until 1996, it is that during that period, work took the place of everything else in my life. Whatever effect multiple school expulsions, social and academic failures, and the final degradation of imprisonment may have had on me, I think it true that my last gasp escape into Cambridge and the discovery that there was work I could do and be valued for doing galvanized me into an orgy of concentrated labor from which I could not and would not be diverted, not even by the prospect of sexual or romantic fulfillment. Perhaps career, concentration, commitment, and creation had become my new drugs of choice. Work can be an addiction like any other. Love of it can be a home wrecker, an obsession that bores, upsets, insults, and worries those close to you. We all know that drugs, alcohol, and tobacco are bad, but work, we are brought up to believe, is good. As a result, the world is full of families who are angry at being abandoned, and breadwinners who are even more angry because their hours of labour are not sufficiently appreciated. "I do it for you," they cry. While it may be true that work puts meat on the table, everyone around them knows that hard workers do it for themselves. Most children of workaholics would rather see less money and more of their parent. Within a year of leaving Cambridge, friends and family were already referring to my apparent inability to use the word no. I soon began to hear myself described as a workaholic. Kim preferred the word ergomaniac, partly because he was a classical scholar, and partly, I suspect, because the maniac part better expressed the absurd frenzy with which I was starting to throw myself into every offer that came my way. To this day, I am often reminded by those about me that I don't have to say yes to everything, and that there are such things as holidays. I don't believe them, of course, no matter how many times they assure me it's true. The question that most troublingly refuses to go away is whether my productivity, ubiquity and, well, career harlotry have stopped me from realizing what, in the world of fathers, teachers and grown-ups in general, might be called my full potential. Hugh and Emma, to name the two most obvious of my contemporaries, have never been as recklessly carefree, prodigal and improvident with their talents as I have. I want to say that they have always had reason to believe in their talents more than I have in mine. But then I also want to say that I have had more fun than they have, and that, for when the one great scorer comes to write against your name, he marks not that you won or lost, but how you played the game. Which is all very well, but while I may want to say all kinds of things, I am not sure that they would necessarily be true. I will not go so far as to claim that when falling asleep every night I mourn lost opportunities. Every night would be an exaggeration. There is a vision that comes to me often, though. I picture myself at the surface of an ocean. The course of my life is played out as a descent to the seabed. As I drop down, I clutch at and try to reach blurred but alluring images representing the vocation of writer, actor, comedian, film director, politician, or academic, but they all writhe and ripple flirtatiously out of reach. Or rather, it would be truer to say that I am afraid to leap forward and hug one of them to me. By being afraid to commit to one, I commit to none, and arrive at the bottom empty and unfulfilled. This is a self-aggrandizing, pitiful and absurd fantasy of regret, I know, but it is a frequent one. I close whatever book I've been reading in bed, and that same film plays out again and again in my mind before I sleep. I know that I have a reputation for cleverness and articulacy, but I also know that people must wonder why I haven't quite done better with my life and talents. A jack of so many trades, and manifestly a master of none. In my perkier moods, I'm entirely pleased with this outcome, for I refuse to stand on a carpet in a headmaster's study and endure wise shakings of the head and heavy school report pronouncements about my shortcomings. Such attitudes are grotesque, impudent, and irrelevant. Could do better is a meaningless conclusion. Could be happier is the only one that counts. I have had 5 times the opportunities and experiences accorded to most, and if the result is a disappointment to posterity, well, posterity can eat it. In less perky moods, of course, I entirely concur with the judgments of the headshakers and school report pronouncers. What a waste! What a fatuous, selfish, air-headed, indolent, and insulting waste my life has been. While it is not exactly counterintuitive, it may perhaps be less than immediately obvious to point out that it is a great deal more conceited of me to bemoan my life as a waste than for me to be more or less satisfied at the way it has turned out. Any regret at my lack of achievement suggests that I really believe that I had in me the ability, should I have concentrated on any one thing, to have written a great novel, or to have been a great actor, director, playwright, poet, or statesman, or whatever else I might delude myself I had the potential for. Whether or not I have the ability to be any of those things, I do know that I lack the ambition, concentration, focus, and above all, will, without which such talents are as useless as an engine without fuel. Which is not to say that I'm lazy or unambitious in the short term. You might say I am good at tactics but hopeless at strategy, happy to slog away at whatever is in front of me but unable to take a long view, plan ahead or imagine the future. A good golfer, they say, has to picture his swing before he addresses the ball in order to drive. My whole life has been an adventure in hit and hope. But sex. Yes, we have to return, I fear, to sex. We were discussing that commission for the Tatler. I wrote the article for Jonathan Meads, outlining my distaste for being cursed by nature with an urgent instinct to rummage about in the damp, dark, foul-smelling and revoltingly tufted areas of the human body that constitute the main dishes in the banquet of love, and my sense that the whole business was humiliating, disgusting and irksome. I suggested that a life without sex and without the presence of a partner offered numerous benefits. The celibate life allowed productivity, independence and ease, free from the pressures of placating and accommodating the will and desires of another, released from the degrading imperatives of erotic congress, a new and better life could be lived. Sex was an overrated bore. Besides, I confessed as I ended the article, I'm scared that I may not be very good at it. The piece was quoted and reproduced in whole or in part in several newspapers, and for the next 12 years it was rare for this particular C-word not to be attached to me, much as macrobiotic is attached to Gwyneth Paltrow and tantric to Sting. I joined Cliff Richard and Morrissey as one of celibacy's peculiar poster children. Profilers, chat show hosts and interviewers in the years to come would regularly ask if I was still keeping it up, ho-ho, whether I would recommend sexual abstinence as a way of life, and how I coped with the loneliness of the single state. I had created a rod for my own back with this article, but have never regretted writing it. It was, more or less, inasmuch as these things ever are, true. I did find the business of Eros a nuisance and an embarrassment. I did enjoy the independence and freedom afforded me by being unattached, and I was afraid that I might not be very good at sex. Am I going to deny my terror of rejection or my low sense of my own physical worth? With the passing of each year, the odds against me ever forging a full relationship lengthened as I felt myself less and less practiced in the arts of love and less confident about how I would ever go about finding a partner, even supposing that I wanted one. There was just so much to do. I was rehearsing in London prior to going down to Chichester to start 40 years on. I was working on Me and My Girl, chugging out journalism and taking enthusiastic steps in another medium. Radio. Characters and the Corporation. Ever since I can remember, I have loved radio, especially the kind of talk radio that only the BBC Home Service, later Radio 4, provides. Throughout my insomniac youth, I listened through the day right up to the national anthem when I would retune to the BBC World Service. England made me, Anthony Farren says to himself in the Graham Greene novel of that title. England made me, too, but it was an England broadcast on 1,500 metres long wave. I wrote this as the opening of an article on the World Service for Arena magazine. BBC World Service, the news read by Roger Collinge. The warm brown tones trickle out of Bush House like honey from a jar, rich and resonant on the long and medium waves for domestic listeners, or bright and sibilant on the short wave for 100 million Anglophone citizens of the world, for whose benefit the precious signal is bounced off the atmosphere from relay station to relay station through ionospheric storms and the rude, jostling traffic of 100,000 intrusive foreign transmissions to arrive fresh and crackling on the veranda table. Oh, to be in England now that England's gone. This World Service, this little Bakelite gateway into the world of Sydney Box, Charters and Caldicott, Maserati Tea, Kennedy's Latin Primer, and dark, glistening streets. An England that never was, conjured into the air by nothing more than accents, march tunes, and a meiotic, self-deprecating style that in its dishonesty is brassier and brasher than Disneyland. A Mary Poppins service, glamorous in its drab severity, merry in its stern routine and inexhaustible resource, a twinkling authoritarian that fulfills our deepest fantasy by simply staying, even though the wind changed long ago. Ooh, I love it. I'm sure I knew what I meant at the time by the World Service's dishonesty, but the truth is I still adored and valued radio above television. Radio 4's mix of comedy, news, documentary, drama, magazine, panel game and quirky discussion is unique and was central to the fashioning of my outlook and manner. I grew up to the sound of warmly assured and calmly authoritative BBC voices vibrating the fabric speaker covers of Valve wireless sets manufactured by Bush, Ferguson, Roberts and Pye. One of my first ever memories is sitting under my mother's chair in our house in Chesham while she tapped away on her typewriter with characters from The Archers arguing about dairy cattle in the background. My music, my word, a word in edgeways, stop the week, start the week, any answers, any questions, 20 questions, many a slip, does the team think, brain of Britain, from our own correspondent, the petticoat line, file on four, down your way, the world at one, today, PM, you and yours, woman's hour, letter from America, Jack DeManio precisely, the men from the ministry, gardener's question time, the Burkis way, the Jason explanation, round Britain quiz, just a minute, I'm sorry I haven't a clue, desert island discs, and 100 other dramas, comedies, quizzes and features have amused, amazed, enriched, enraged, informed and inflamed me from the earliest age. My voice, I think, owes more to the BBC microphone and the dusty, slow-to-warm-up mullard valve than to the accents and tones of my family, friends and schoolfellows. Just as there are the lazily sucked bones of Woodhouse, Wilde and Waugh in my writing style, if style is the right word for it, so the intonations of John Ebden, Robert Robinson, Franklin Jingle Engelman, Richard Stinker Murdoch, Derek Giler, Margaret Howard, David Jacobs, Kenneth Robinson, Richard Baker, Anthony Quinton, John Julius Norwich, Alistair Cook, David Jason, Brian Johnston, John Timpson, Jack DeManio, Steve Race, Frank Muir, Dennis Norton, Nicholas Parsons, Kenneth Williams, Derek Nimmo, Peter Jones, Nelson Gabriel, Derek Cooper, Clive Jacobs, Martin Munkester and Brian Perkins have penetrated my brain and being to the extent that, much as heavy metal pollutants get into the hair and skin and nails and tissue, they have become a physical as well as an emotional and intellectual part of me. We are all the sum of countless influences. I like to believe that Shakespeare, Keats, Dickens, Austen, Joyce, Eliot, Auden, and the great and noble grandees of literature have had their effect on me, but the truth is they were distant uncles and aunts, good for a fiver at Christmas and a book token on birthdays, while Radio 4 and the BBC World Service were my mother and father, a daily presence and constant example. I believed from the earliest age that I would be quite content to work in radio all my life. If I could just be a continuity announcer or regular broadcaster of some kind, how happy I would be. My dislike of my facial features and physical form contributed to this ambition. I had, as the tired old joke goes, a good face for radio. Announcers and broadcasters have no need of makeup or costume. For one who believed that any attempt at prettification on my part would only draw attention to my cursed deficiencies, a life in front of the microphone seemed like the perfect career. How much more realistic for me a national radio station than irrational Venus station? My first visits to Broadcasting House, the home of BBC Radio in Portland Place, had been as early as 1982, when I played a fictional news reporter for a Radio 1 programme called, I think, B15. The basement studios in Broadcasting House were all BX, and I honestly cannot remember the value of the X which gave this programme its name. In its short run, B14 or B12 or whatever it may have called itself, was presented by David Kidd Jensen, an amiable Canadian disc jockey, best known, according to a friend of mine who is very keen on this kind of thing, for being the least objectionable presenter of Top of the Pops in all its long history. My character on B-whatever, Beavis Marchant, had his own little slot called Beat News, a rather obvious parody of Radio 1's ludicrously urgent, trivial and self-important news beat. Within 2 weeks of me contributing to this programme, Margaret Thatcher had dispatched a task force to recapture the Falkland Islands, and a week later I was taken off the air. My parody of Brian Hanrahan and others was deemed insensitive. I shouted over an electric egg beater in a bucket to recreate the sound of reporting live from a helicopter. I was, in fact, mocking the grandiose faux butch reporting style, not making light of the danger that the military were in, but that has always been too complicated a distinction for stupid people to understand. There was a war on, I was trying to be funny, therefore I had contempt for the sacrifice and bravery of the troops. My levity was tantamount to treason and must be stopped. I think I'm angrier about that now than I ever was at the time. Pomposity and indignation grow in old age like nostril hairs and earlobes. Not long after Beat News, a BBC producer called Ian Guardhouse was in touch with me about contributing to a Radio 4 programme of his called Late Night Sherrin. Ned Sherrin was a well-known broadcaster who had started life as a television producer, first at Val Parnell's ATV and then at the BBC. His most famous achievement in that phase of his life had been That Was the Week That Was, usually referred to as TW3, the live comedy show that had launched the satire boom and David Frost. Since then, Nedwin, as I like to call him, had given the world Up Pompeii, Side by Side by Sondheim, and a slew of collaborations with Carol Brahms and others. Trained as a lawyer, he was known for his love of Tin Pan Alley, rich gossip, and comely young men. He received his education at Exeter College, Oxford, where he read law, but before that he had been a boy at the most excellently named educational establishment in the history of the world, Sexes School in Somerset. I took to Ned straight away. He was like a stern aunt who twinkled and giggled after a little too much gin. The idea behind Late Night Sherrin was to have a hero or heroine guest of the week who would be twitted and teased by Ned and an assortment of young witty types, of which I was to be one. Ned called us his Young Turks. Late Night Sherry morphed, for reasons neither I nor Ian Guardhouse can remember, into And So to Ned. They were both live late-night shows. The routine was for us all to meet for supper, high up in the St. George's Hotel, just by Broadcasting House. The motive behind this, according to Ian, was so that he and Ned could keep an eye on the guests of the week and make sure they stayed relatively sober, a stratagem that failed riotously in the cases of Daniel Farson and Zsa Zsa Gabor. After And So to Ned's short life came Extra Dry Sherrin, whose format I cannot remember as being any different from the others. Possibly it had live music or no live music or three guests instead of two. Extra Dry Sherrin lasted one series before Ian welcomed me into a new Sherrin-free live 100-minute programme called The Colour Supplement. As the name suggests, this was a Sunday magazine show comprising a variety of features, one of which would be a section I could create and shape for myself in any way I chose. Each week I performed a kind of monologue as a different character, an estate agent, an architect, a journalist. I cannot remember the whole gallery. Their surnames usually came from Norfolk villages, so I do recall a Simon Mulbarton, a Sandy Crimplesham, and a Gerald Clench Wharton. It was unfortunate that the pay packets offered proved that the rest of the world held radio in no real esteem. I had grown up hearing Kenneth Williams and others bemoaning in quavering comic tones the insultingly nugatory fees that they'd been offered for their services, and I soon found out that, compared to her brash younger brother Television, Dame Wireless did indeed live the most frugal and threadbare existence. This never worried me. I would have done it for free. But it was sometimes hard to persuade Richard Armitage that hours composing broadcast monologues, taking parts in comedies and dramas, and guesting on panel games were not a waste of time or beneath, as he seemed to think, my dignity. Radio is the poor relation of television insofar as monetary considerations go, but a rich one where it matters in terms of depth and intimacy. The writer Tony Sarche and producer Paul Mayhew Archer asked me to play an earnest investigative reporter called David Lander in Delve Special, a new comedy series they were creating. It was essentially a parody of Checkpoint, the very popular Radio 4 programme which featured doughty New Zealander Roger Cook, inquiring into a different con, scam or swindle each week. The first part of the programme would catalogue the miseries of the unfortunates who had been exploited and ripped off. They might have had their house destroyed by expensive but incompetent pebble-dashing, been duped into buying a non-existent timeshare villa, invested their savings in... There were any number of ways that innocent lambs could be fleeced by rascally villains, the doorstepping confrontations with whom formed the second and most compulsively enjoyable part of the programme. Cook was famous for getting chiyiked, insulted, jostled, roughed up, and even seriously assaulted by the angry subjects of his exposés. Delve Special barely had to exaggerate the stories that Checkpoint and its successor, John Waite's Face the Facts, already provided. Over the next 3 years, we made 4 series, and then, when Roger Cook jumped to television, we jumped with him, being screened for a run of 6 programmes on Channel 4 as This Is David Lander, for which I wore a quite monstrous blonde wig. When my workload was simply too heavy to allow me to do a second series, Tony Slattery stepped in, and the show was retitled This Is David Harper. One of the pleasures of making Delve for radio, aside from not having to wear a wig or care how I looked at all, was working with the guest performers who came along to play the victims and perpetrators. Brenda Blethyn, Harry Enfield, Dawn French, Andrew Sachs, Felicity Montague, Jack Claff, Janine Duvitsky and many others came into the studio and gave of their brilliant best. Actually, into the studio is not quite accurate. In order to achieve oral verisimilitude, Paul Mayhew Archer would often place us in the street, on the roof of Broadcasting House, in broom cupboards, catering areas, offices, corridors and hallways, so that he and his engineer could capture the authentic tone and atmosphere of the scene. Location radio drama is not common, and the, "Sir, sir, it's a lovely day, can we have our lessons outside?" sort of mood that it engendered made the recordings about as larky as such sessions can ever be. Meanwhile, still with radio, the colour supplement soon folded. Ian invited me to participate in yet another piece of Sherinry, this time a live Saturday morning show called Loose Ends, or Loose Neds, as the regular contributors preferred to call it. Over the years, these included Victoria Mather, Carol Thatcher, Emma Freud, Graham Norton, Arthur Smith, Brian Sewell, Robert Elms, and Victor Lewis Smith. The format was always the same. Around the table, whose top was laid with green baize cloth, sat the regular contributors and a couple of guest authors, actors or musicians who had some new release to plug. Ned would open with a monologue in which the week's news was jokily reviewed. He was always very good at crediting the monologue's author. In the early years, this was usually Neil Shand or Alastair Beaton, his collaborator on a pair of satirical Gilbert and Sullivan adaptations, The Ratepayer's Iolanthe and The Metropolitan Mikado, romping satires on the Ken Livingstone-Margaret Thatcher face-off, which played to great applause in the mid-80s. After the monologue, Ned introduced some feature which would have been pre-recorded by a regular contributor. "Carol, I believe you went off to investigate this phenomenon." "Well, Ned," Carol would say, and give a little preamble to her recorded passage. "Emma, you braved the dawn on Beachy Head to get a first-hand view, is that right?" "Well, Ned." I christened Emma, Carol and Victoria the Well Neds, and they stayed with the programme for as long as anyone. For my first few contributions to Loose Ends, I presented a range of characters, much as I had on the colour supplement. One week, there was a news story about an academic who had been made to watch hours and hours of television in order to compile a report on whether or not the programming was injurious to the British public, especially its youth. There was much talk in those days about the evils of scenes of violence in cop shows and their deleterious influence on the impressionable minds of the young. For reasons which now seem difficult to reconstruct imaginatively, Starsky and Hutch, of all programmes, was singled out as a major culprit, a symbol of all that was wrong. The nice Mr. Guardhouse, as Ned called Ian, suggested that I do a piece as an academic forced to watch television. So I tapped away that Friday afternoon and came in the next day with a piece written in the persona of a Professor Donald Trefusis, extraordinary fellow of St. Matthew's College, Cambridge, philologist and holder of the Regis Chair of Comparative Linguistics. Trefusis, it turned out, was indeed horrified at the violence of British television. The violence done to his sensibilities and the sensibilities of a young and vulnerable generation by Noel Edmonds and Terry Wogan and others made him shudder and shake. Thank goodness, he concluded, for the jolly car chases and fight scenes where actors dressed as policemen pretend to shoot each other. Without innocent merriment of that kind, television would be insupportably damaging to the young. Heavy steamroller irony, I suppose, but issuing from the querulous mouth of a gabbling tweedy don, too old to care whom he might offend, it seemed to work well. Well enough, at any rate, to encourage me to keep the character and try something similar the following week. Soon, Trefusis became my sole weekly contributor. A paragraph of introduction would suggest the fiction that I, Stephen Fry, had gone round to his rooms at St. Matthew's to interview him. The professor started to get a trickle of fan mail. One piece, in which he savagely tore into the fad for parent power in education, turned the trickle into a flood of hundreds of letters, most of them asking for a transcript of the talk, or wireless essay, as he preferred to call them. Trefusis's age and perceived wisdom and authority allowed me to be ruder and more savagely satirical than I could ever have been in my own vocal persona. The British are like that, especially the middle-class Radio 4 audience. A young, snappy, angry person annoys them, and they shout at the radio for him to show some respect and get the spiritual and intellectual equivalent of a haircut. But let the same sentiments exactly, word for word, be uttered in high academic tones, as if by a compound of G.E. Moore, Bertrand Russell and Anthony Quinton, and they will roll onto their tummies and purr. For the next 4 or 5 years, I fed loose ends on an almost exclusive diet of Trefusis. Just occasionally I might appear in the guise of another character. Ned's favourite alternative to the professor was Rosina Lady Madding, a kind of crazed old Diana Cooper figure. Her voice was a compound of Edith Evans and my prep school elocution teacher.
"I hope you don't mind sitting in here. At my age you get rather fond of draughts. I know you young people feel the cold terribly, but I'm afraid I rather like it. That's right, yes, it is nice, isn't it? Though I wouldn't really call it a cushion. Pekingese is a more common name for them. No, well, never mind, he was very old. Just throw him on the fire, would you?"
Colonel and Mrs. Chichester. In April 1984, I drove down to Sussex to start my summer of 40 years on. I'll run through the cast list. Paul Eddington had been promoted to the part that he had watched John Gielgud play nearly 16 years earlier, that of the headmaster. Eddington was, of course, a big star of television situation comedy, well known and loved as Penelope Keith's harassed husband in The Good Life, and more recently as Jim Hacker, the hopeless and hapless Minister for Administrative Affairs in the immensely popular Yes Minister. He had been very friendly during the rehearsals in London, but I couldn't help being slightly in awe of him. I'd never worked in daily proximity with someone quite so famous before. John Fortune took the role of Franklin that Paul had played in the original production. John was one of the greats of Cambridge comedy, with John Bird, Eleanor Bron, and Timothy Birdsall back in the late 50s. He had created with Eleanor Bron the legendary and wiped series Where Was Spring? His partnership with John Bird was to achieve great prominence again in the late 90s and beyond with their wildly intelligent and prescient satirical contributions to Bremner, Bird and Fortune. Annette Crosby played the school matron. She's now best known as Victor Meldrew's wife in One Foot in the Grave, but I remembered her as a fiercely glamorous Queen Victoria in Edward VII and an almost impossibly perky and delicious fairy godmother in The Slipper and the Rose. Doris Hare appeared as the old grandmother. She was 79 and a magisterial trooper of the old school, much loved for her years of playing Reg Varney's mother in On the Buses. A fine young actor called Stephen Rashbrook took the part of the head prefect, while the rest of the school were played by local West Sussex boys. The Chichester Festival, begun in the 60s by Leslie Evershed Martin and Laurence Olivier, presented each year a long summer of plays and musicals in a large, purpose-built, thrust-stage theatre. The 1984 season offered The Merchant of Venice, The Way of the World and O.K., as well as the 40 years on that I had come down for. A tent, since replaced by a fully-fledged second house called the Minerva, served as a space for smaller, experimental productions. As a gig, as a booking, Chichester was much prized by old-school actors who liked the relaxed atmosphere of a prosperous South Coast town, a long season in repertory that didn't make too many demands, and the security of guaranteed festival attendance. This regular local audience was known collectively as Colonel and Mrs. Chichester on account of their severe and hidebound tastes. Ratigan seemed to be the only post-war playwright they were able to stomach. Colonel and Mrs. Chichester were not afraid to impart the exciting news that they went to the theatre to be entertained. Patrick Garland was a delightful director, courteous, intelligent, benign, and delicately tactful. In rehearsal, he had an endearing habit of addressing the perplexed boys in the cast as if they were members of an Oxbridge common room. "Forgive my mentioning it, gentlemen, but I do feel myself constrained to observe that the dilatory nature of the communal egress immediately consequent upon Paul's second act exordium is injurious to the pace and dynamism of the scene. I would be so grateful if this deficiency were remedied with grateful thanks." The play's designer was Peter Rice, whose son Matthew soon became a lifelong friend. When not assisting his father, he dug the garden of the little house he had hired for the season, shot rabbits and pigeons, skinned and plucked same, and cooked them into exquisite suppers. He played the piano, sang songs, sketched and painted. His voice was not unlike Princess Margaret's, high, grand and piercing. Perhaps he had spent too much time in her presence, being a close friend of her son, David Linley, with whom he had been at Beedale's. Unlike Matthew, whose cottage was a charming rural retreat in the Earl of Bessborough's estate, I had taken a rather dull modern flat a short walk from the Festival Theatre. I devoted my spare time to the script of Me and My Girl. Once or twice, Mike Ockrent came down to work on it with me. Robert Lindsay had been duly cast as Bill, and the part of Sally was to be taken by Leslie Ash, subject to her taking lessons in tap and singing. The major character role of Sir John had been given to Frank Thornton, better known as the Grace Brothers floorwalker Captain Peacock in Are You Being Served? The show's opening was all set for autumn in Leicester, if I could just deliver a final rehearsal script within the next month. My parents came down to Chichester from Norfolk for 40 Years On's first night. I proudly introduced them to Alan Bennett and Paul Eddington. Alan, in turn, introduced us to his friends Alan Bates and Russell Harty. "I love a play where there are laughs and sobs," said Alan Bates, in a much camper voice than I would have imagined could ever issue from the lips of the go-betweens Ted Burgess and Far From the Madding Crowd's Gabriel Oak, two of the manliest men in all of British film. "I mean, you've got to have a giggle and a gulp, haven't you, or what's the theatre for?" Russell Harty, with anagrammatic diablerie, referred to Alan Bates as Anal Beast, or in mixed company, Lana Beast. I think I was disappointing as Tempest. In my mind, I believed that I could play the part and play it with brilliance, but something held me back from being any better than competent. I was okay. Perfectly good. Fine. That last is the worst word in theatre. When friends come backstage and use the word fine about a play, a production or your performance, you know they hated it. Often they preface it out of nowhere with the word no, which is fantastically revealing. No, it was fine. No, really, I thought it was, you know. Why would they open a sentence with no when they have not even been asked a question? There can only be one explanation. As they walk along the backstage corridors towards your dressing room, they have said inside their own head, "God, that stank. Stephen was embarrassingly awful. The whole thing was ghastly." Then they enter, and as if answering and contradicting themselves, they instantly say, "No, I thought it was great. No, really, I liked it." I know this is right because I so often catch myself doing exactly the same thing without meaning to. No, really, it was fine. The production as a whole was considered a success, however. Colonel and Mrs. Chichester enthused, and word soon got out that we were going to transfer. "Excellent news," Paul Eddington said to me one evening as we stood waiting to go on. I nearly wrote, "as we stood in the wings," but Chichester had an apron stage that thrust out into the auditorium on three sides, so we must have been standing behind the set. "Oh," I said, "what good news?" "It's official. We're going to transfer. Wow! I did a little dance. I had no idea what he was talking about. It took me 2 days to work out the meaning of transfer. The boys in the cast seemed to know. The women who served in the cafeteria knew. The tobacconist on the corner and the landlady of my flat knew. Everyone knew, except me. "Wonderful news about the transfer," said Doris Hare. "The Queen's, I believe." Did a transfer mean a royal visit? Now I was even more puzzled. "I've played most of the houses on the Avenue, but this will be the first time I've played the Queen's." The Avenue? I pictured us in some tree-lined boulevard giving an outdoor performance to a bored and affronted monarch. The idea seemed grotesque. Later, Patrick said to me, "You will have heard the good news about the transfer?" "Indeed, yeah. Great, isn't it? This will be your West End debut, I think." So that is what it meant. The production would be transferred from Chichester to the West End. A transfer, of course. Duh. I finished the Chichester season in a frenzy. Mike Ockrent came to collect my final draft of Me and My Girl a week before we closed. Back in London, I decided, since Kim and Steve were so happy together at Draycott Place, that it was time for me to move out of Chelsea and set up on my own. For £100 a week, I found myself the tenant of a furnished one-bedroom flat in Regent Square, Bloomsbury. Just me and the new love of my life. Computer 2. Early in the year, I had called Hugh up excitedly. "I've just bought a Macintosh. Cost me £1,000. "What?" Hugh enjoyed about a week of relaying the news of my fantastic expenditure on something as absurd and unworthy of outlay as a raincoat before he discovered that this Macintosh was a new type of computer. I was more insanely in love with this strangely beautiful piece of technology than anything I had ever owned before. It had a cable leading out of it that ended in a device called a mouse. The screen was white when you started it all up and loaded the system disk. The text that came up was black on white, like paper, instead of the fuzzily glowing green or orange on black offered by all other computers. An arrow on the screen could be activated by moving the mouse on the desk next to the computer. Images of a floppy disk and a dustbin appeared on screen, and all along the top were words which, when clicked on with the mouse, pulled down a kind of graphical roller blind on which menu options were written. You could double-click on pictures of documents and folders, and window panes would open. I had never seen or imagined anything like it, nor had anyone. Only Apple's short-lived Lisa computer had used this way of doing things before, and it had never had a place in the consumer or home market. While it was being developed, this graphical user interface had been referred to as WIMP, standing for Windows, Icons, Menus, Pointing Device. I was instantly a slave to its elegance, ease, usefulness, and wit. Most of you reading this will be too young to imagine a time when computers could have been presented in any other fashion, but this was new and revolutionary. Extraordinarily, it didn't catch on for ages. For years and years after the January 1984 release of the Apple Macintosh, the rivals, IBM, Microsoft, Apricot, DEC, Amstrad and others, all dismissed the mouse, the icon and the graphical desktop as gimmicky, childish and a passing fad. Well, I shall refrain from going too deeply into the subject. I'm fully aware of how minority a sport my love of all this dorky wizardry is. All you need know is that I, my 128 kilobyte Macintosh, image writer bitmap printer, and small collection of floppy disks were all very, very happy together. What possible need could I have for sex or human relationships when I had this? Hugh, Katie and Nick Simmons shared a house in Leighton Grove, Kentish Town. I had my Bloomsbury flat. Kim stayed on in Chelsea. We all saw each other as much as possible, but I was about to be busy performing 8 times a week on the West End stage. Richard Armitage had arranged with Patrick and the 40 Years On producers that in November I would be released from the run of the play for a few days so that I could travel up to Leicester for the opening of Me and My Girl. This contractual clause was insisted upon not because Richard kindly believed I should have the treat of attending the first night of a musical to which I had contributed a script, but because he wanted to be sure that I would be on hand should the dress rehearsal and opening demonstrate a need for urgent, unforeseen rewrites. We had participated in some strange conversations over the preceding months, in which Richard had proved himself capable of changing hats mid-sentence, shuttling between his identity as the show's producer, the heir and manager of the composer's estate, and not least, so far as I was concerned, my agent. "I've had a word with myself," he would say, "and I have agreed to my outrageous demands as to your financial participation in this project. I wanted to cut you out of any back end, but I absolutely insisted. So much to my annoyance, you have points in the show, which pleases me greatly." Early on in the rehearsal process, Leslie Ash had not responded well to her dance and vocal lessons, and by mutual agreement, she had dropped out of the cast. I sat in Richard's office one afternoon as he rubbed his chin anxiously. Who on earth could we cast as Sally? "What about Emma?" I said. "She sings wonderfully, and while she may not have done any tap dancing, she's surely the kind of person who can do anything she turns her mind to." Richard's personality once more split before my eyes. "Of course. Brilliant. I want her," he said, before riposting, "Well, if you do, you'll damn well have to pay through the nose for her. Oh, come now, be reasonable. She has no experience, no real name. That's as may be. She's one of the greatest talents of her generation, and as such, she'll cost you." I left Richard to wrestle the matter. I understood that he fell short of actually beating himself up and managed before too long to end his tense negotiations by shaking his hand on a deal satisfactory to both of him. Emma duly joined the cast. She knew Robert Lindsay well, having worked at the Royal Exchange in Manchester, where Robert had presented his excellently received Hamlet. In fact, I believe I am right in saying that Emma and Robert had known each other very well back then. Really, jolly well indeed. Oh, yes. 40 Years On had to undergo one or two cast changes for its West End run. John Fortune and Annette Crosby were unavailable for the transfer, and their roles went to David Horovitch and Emma's mother, Phyllida Delaw. The boys were recast too. The local Chichester lads, who had thrown themselves into their roles with such aplomb and good spirits, were now replaced by London stage school professionals, who were just as sparky and cheerful and a great deal more streetwise and experienced. The day before the opening, during the interval between the technical run and the evening dress rehearsal, I walked out of the Queen's Theatre stage door with David Horovitch and a group of these boys, heading for a pasta restaurant that they, with their Soho savvy, had recommended. Alan Bennett was out in the street, attaching bicycle clips to his trousers. "Are you going to join us for spaghetti?" I asked him. "Yes, do," said the boys. "Oh, no," said Alan in slightly shocked tones, as if we were inviting him to a naked orgy in an opium den. "I shall cycle home and have a poached egg." Alan Bennett is always excellent at being as much like Alan Bennett as you could reasonably hope. A keen mind, a powerful artistic sensibility, a fierce political and social conscience, but a man of bicycle clips and poached eggs. Is it any wonder that he is so loved? My name was now up in neon on Shaftesbury Avenue. I was too embarrassed to take a picture, which now, of course, I regret. I do have a photograph of the first night party. I should imagine I was very happy. I had every reason to be. Paul Eddington was happy too, enjoying a ripe and fruity time in his career. He had just been elected to the Garrick Club, which gave him enormous pleasure, and he and Nigel Hawthorne had been paid a large sum of money for a TV commercial, which pleased him almost as much. "A very large sum," he said happily. "It's to advertise a new Cadbury's chocolate bar called Whisper. Nigel whispers in my ear in his Sir Humphrey character. Half a day's work for the most extraordinary fee." "Gosh," I said, "and do Tony Jay and Jonathan Lynn get a good wedge too?" "Ah." Paul winced slightly at my mention of the names of the writers and creators of Yes, Minister, a mention I had not made mischievously, but out of genuine curiosity as to how these things worked. "Yes, Nigel and I had a twinge of guilt about that, so we're sending them each a case of claret. Jolly good claret." There is a chasm between writers and performers. For each, life often looks better across the divide. And while I am sure Tony and Jonathan were pleased to receive their case of jolly good claret, I cannot doubt that they may have preferred the kind of remuneration Paul and Nigel were enjoying. As I was to discover, however, writing has its rewards too. One night, as the curtain came down, Paul whispered in my ear with delighted triumph, "I can tell you now, it's official. I'm Prime Minister." That night, the final episode of Yes Minister had been broadcast. It ended with Jim Hacker succeeding to the leadership of his party and the country. Keeping the secret, Paul had told me, had been the hardest job he had ever had. I settled into the run of the play. There were 6 evening performances a week, with matinees on Wednesdays and Saturdays. I would be saying the same lines to the same people, wearing the same clothes and handling the same props, 8 times a week for the next 6 months. Next door in the Globe Theatre, now called the Gielgud, a show set in a girls' school called Daisy Pulls It Off was running, and the cast of schoolgirls and schoolboys in each got on very well together, as you might imagine. Each Wednesday afternoon, in the interval between matinee and evening performance, there would be a backstage school feast, the boys hosting in the Queen's one week, the girls in the Globe the next. Further along the street stood the Lyric Theatre, where Leonard Rossiter was playing Truscott in a revival of Joe Orton's Lute. One evening, we were stunned to hear that he had collapsed and died of a heart attack just before going on. Only a few months earlier, both Tommy Cooper and Eric Morecambe had also died on stage. A small, selfish and shameful part of me regretted the certainty that I would now never meet or work with those 3 geniuses, at least as much as I mourned their passing or felt for the desolation such sudden deaths must have brought their families. November came, and it was time for me to go up to Leicester for the opening of Me and My Girl. The plan was to arrive on Thursday for the dress rehearsal, stay on Friday for the first night, and be back in London in time for the Saturday matinee and evening shows of 40 Years On. Who, meanwhile, would be taking my place as Tempest? I was horrified to discover that it would be Alan Bennett himself, reprising his original performance from 1968. Horrified because I would, naturally, miss the chance to see him. He came into the dressing room I shared with David Horovitch on the Monday evening of that week. "Oh, Stephen, I've got a funny request. I don't know if you'll want to accede, but I'll put it to you anyway."
"Yes?"
"I know you aren't going till Thursday, but would you mind if I went on as Tempest on the Wednesday matinee and evening as well?"
"Oh, goodness, not at all, not at all!"
The dear fellow was obviously a little nervous and wanted to dip his toes in the water and feel his way back into the role with a smaller matinee audience. The wonderful part of it all was that I could now be in that audience and watch him for 2 performances. It is not often that an actor gets to see a production he is in, and while many prefer not to watch someone else playing their own part, especially if it is a master like Bennett, I was too much the fan to care if the comparison cast me in the shade, which I knew it would. After all, he wrote Tempest for himself, and he was, Alan, for heaven's sake, Bennett. I watched him both times and went round to the dressing room. "Oh, Alan, you were astounding, astounding. Oh, do you think so, really? I'm so pleased you were on today, but you know," I said, "you absolutely didn't need to ease yourself in with a matinee performance. You were perfect from the start."
"Oh, that isn't why I asked if I could go on today."
"It isn't?"
"To be honest, no."
"Well, why then?"
"Well, you know, I've got this film."
Indeed, I did know. Alan had written the screenplay for a film called A Private Function, which starred Maggie Smith, Michael Palin and Denham Elliot. I was planning to catch it over the weekend.
"You see," he said, "it's the Royal Command premiere this evening, and I wanted a solid excuse not to have to go."
It is a very Bennett-y kind of shyness that sees performing on stage in front of hundreds of strangers as less stressful than attending a party. Leicester passed in a blur.
The dress rehearsal of Me and My Girl seemed fine, but without an audience it was impossible to tell whether any of the slapstick and big comic routines would really work. Robert and Emma were wonderful together. Robert's comedy business with his cloak, with his bowler hat, with cigarettes, cushions and any other props that came his way was masterly. I hadn't seen physical comedy this good outside silent pictures. I went round the dressing rooms with good luck bottles of champagne, cards, bunches of roses, and expressions of faith, hope, and gratitude. "Well, we're waiting for the final director now," said Frank Thornton, adding in his most lugubrious manner the answer to my unspoken question. "The audience." "Ah," I nodded at this wise actorly thought. In the end, the final director jerked up their thumbs with a loud Lambeth walk. "Oi!" They stood and cheered at the end for what seemed like half an hour. It was a most wonderful triumph, and everybody hugged each other and sobbed with joy, just as they do in the best Hollywood backstage musicals. Mike Ockrent's magical and comically detailed direction, Gillian Gregory's choreography, Mike Walker's arrangements, and a chorus and cast that threw themselves body and soul into every second of the 2 hours' running time ensured as happy an evening as I can remember in the theatre. I would not want to be misunderstood. Musicals are still not quite my thing, and I'm sure there are plenty of you who will wince at the thought of pearly kings and queens and larky high kicks accompanying a 1930s rumpty-tumpty score. Nonetheless, I was pleased to be involved with something so alien to my usual tastes and which bubbled and bounced with such unaffected lightness of touch and warm silliness and unapologetic high spirits. We bucked the trend for self-regarding, high-toned, through-sung, operatic melodramas. Not just bucked, buck-and-winged. I liked the fact that we were presenting an evening that paid homage to the origins of the word musical as an adjective, not a noun. From its beginnings, the genre was musical comedy, and we had all hoped that there was still a demand for that kind of theatre. At the party, I leant forward to a beaming Richard Armitage. "Do you think," I yelled in his ear, flaunting my theatrical jargon, "that we will transfer?" "Sure of it," said Richard. "Thank you, my dear. My father is looking down and winking." I turned away, a tear in my eye. I knew how important it is for men to feel that they have finally earned the approval of their fathers. Conspicuous consumption. Country cottages, checks, credit cards, and classic cars. Back in London, the run of 40 years on continued through Christmas and the New Year. I had started to cross off the days on a chart in the dressing room, like a prisoner scratching on the wall of his cell. There is something quite dreadful about what enforced repetition of action and speech does to the brain. Experienced stage actors all know how common it is to suffer a kind of out-of-body experience on stage where you look down and helplessly watch yourself from above. The moment comes to speak your lines and you will either freeze and dry up or say the same speech 3 or 4 times in a row without noticing. Only a pinch or a kick from a fellow actor can save you. There was one scene in 40 years on in which I had to tick a boy off for something or other. I would strike the corner of a desk hard with my index finger in time to the rhythms of my reprimand. One half-empty matinee, I looked down and saw that the varnish on the desk had been worn away by the striking of my finger. For some reason this upset me greatly, and I resolved that evening to strike another part of the desk. When the moment came, I raised my hand, aimed a good 6 inches to the left of the scuff mark, and brought my finger down with a bang on exactly the usual place. For the next few days I tried again and again, but some form of